blinded by the light. I got on my hippie blouse and singing hippie songs. I'm Peg Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and fellowship of people like you and sponsorship, I've been sober since February the 4th, 1964, and I'm very grateful for that. I'd like to thank Joe for asking us to come out here. On the initial program, I was TBA, which is to be announced, and he sent me this program, and I called him up, and I said, Joe, I'm not on here. He said, yes, you're the TBA. So I was here about 5 years ago, I think, and I reminded Joe of that, and he said, I don't care. So I'm back, and I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be with my husband. I always enjoy coming places with him. We don't, obviously we live together, and well, I suppose not obviously, but we do live together. But at home, if you're an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what it's like. I mean, people are calling all the time, and usually you have a mopey pigeon sitting on the front porch, you know. I was just waiting till you woke up, you know, that kind of thing. Which, in pigeon language, to me means, see how good I am to not wake you up at this time of day. But I have this problem. So we're glad to be here because it gives us the opportunity to visit again. And I married Dick in Alcoholics Anonymous. I met and married him. It'll be 40 years this year we've been married. So, whoa, I didn't know that was coming. It's a miracle. Why? It just shows that really you can get married in Alcoholics Anonymous and stay married in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not necessary to have a divorce in Alcoholics Anonymous and choose up sides. You know how everybody chooses sides when you get divorced. So we have been, and we've been happily married. We've moved in AA, and we've been each other's only friends at times when we moved, and he's just a good buddy of mine. He is not my sponsor. Thank you very much. My sponsor lives in Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C., and she has only been my sponsor for a few years because my sponsor of 27 years died 2.5 years ago, and that was a tough transition for me because I am a person who is sponsored. I have always had a sponsor. I don't think I'd be alive today if I did not have a sponsor. I'm convinced of that. But I really don't think that I actually got it. I mean, got it until I began sponsoring other people. Because that is when we pass on the message. This is fine to talk, but boy, it's kitchen table AA. Sitting across the table with somebody talking, pitching Alcoholics Anonymous. That's when I see God in the room. I mean, that's when it really gets done. And when I have it, you know, if I've got this message, that's fine. But then when I pass it on to somebody else and I see their eyes light up, you know how new people, when they first come in, they look like a dog on the freeway, you know, like me up here today, deer in the headlights, you know, it's just, they're just scared to death, but there's nobody home. You know, it's just like, nobody home. Hello, nobody home. And then we say something to them in one of those moments, and it's like, bleep, you know, just the light comes on. It's quickly extinguished, but it does come on. It doesn't last long, those little moments of grace when you're new. It's like, whoa, you know, what was that? I better go back to being miserable. But when we see that, it's the thrill that I was looking for. It makes the hair on my arms stand up. And I know that they have got it. You know, they got it just maybe for a few seconds, but they've got it. And that is worth everything, which is why we need to pass that message on. It isn't any good that I have it. It's not good that I have it. I can't keep it to myself because it's just like a mountain lake. You know, I can have all kinds. If I'm a mountain lake, and you have to pardon me because I'm an artist, so I have very visual stuff. If you don't, usually there's a new guy in the audience looking at me like, that woman's nuts. You know, I don't know what she's talking about. But if I'm a mountain lake and I'm full of fresh water and it does not drain out and new water drain in, then it's going to get stagnant. And that's what happens to us when we're 15, 16, 17 years sober and we've lost the thrill. Do you remember how it felt? If you've been, let me see the hands of people who've been sober longer than 15 years. It's a lot of people. Okay, you know what I'm talking about. When AA becomes, even if it's just for a brief period of time, taken for granted. When that feeling of being in the greatest fellowship in the world ceases to be, and it becomes a right for us to go to meetings. It's a right for us to be sober. It's a right for us to have the good things in our lives. It's our rights. I don't feel that way. And when I'm pitching to AA to a new person, I can't feel that way. I get to go to meetings. I get to be a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to be sober 42 years. I get to be on the firing line of life. I get to have a job. I get to have a husband. I get to have grandchildren. I get to have good relationships with people. I get to do those things. This is a privilege. It's not a right. But I get to, you know, that's us. We have magic, magnifying minds, and by golly, you know, we'll magnify anything. And we just sometimes think our way right out of here. We think our way out of here. Our feet don't carry us. I love what Sharon said about love and love of your feet. You know, I got smart feet. You know, they carry me into meetings. I got a smart car. That car drives me to meetings, and when I want to do a drive-by, you know, I just want to drive right on up. I don't want to listen to him anymore. He goes on and on, Mr. On and on and on and on and on. And you know who Mr. On and On is. He's in every meeting. And he drones. And when your sponsor starts sounding, you want to just not call, and your feet take you to the phone at a certain time every week. And so I got a smart feet and a dumb head. And I'm a binge thinker. I get to thinking about something, and I'll just think it to death. You know, I'm not going to think about it anymore, but she really made me mad, so I think I'll think about her a lot more, and then I'll get mad again, and I can't quit drinking, I couldn't quit drinking. Now I can't quit thinking, and, you know, it's a wonderful time in my head sometimes, you know. Disneyland. Or the casino. That's my head down there. I mean, with the lights flashing and the bing, 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 bing. It's crazy in those places, you know, and they make you walk through there everywhere you go. You have to walk through the casino. And I don't want to, I'm too cheap to gamble away stuff, but I'll tell you what, it makes me nervous. I hurry right through there because that's my head. And I don't want to be confronted with one of my own. So, I belong here in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first started, I said, my name is Peg Martin. And I use my last name, and you have my permission to use it. I am not anonymous within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Actually, I'm not anonymous most anywhere, but I am not anonymous within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are perfectly privileged to use my last name if you'd like, because I do. And I give you that permission. And the reason I do so is because of what I learned in the beginning. When I got sober in Washington, D.C., and it's a very big area. And one of Dick's, my sponsor and Dick's sponsor, lovable Bucky Doyle, said, you know what, we use our last names here because in the middle of the night, when it's the rope or the river, you want a newcomer to be able to get a hold of you. And if they don't have your phone number, they'll want to look you up in the phone book. And there's not going to be able to find lovable Bucky. And he said, I use my last name. And the people I sponsor, I want them to use their last names. And so I have. I do that just because it was what I learned in the beginning. And I'm a superstitious sort. And I've been sober for 42 years. And I'm not messing with it. I'm not messing with it. I respect your anonymity, but I can do with mine what I'm doing this morning. It isn't because he said to me, it isn't because you should think of this as being arrogant. What it is you're trusting someone. You're showing trust in that person. And I have never been hurt by that. Never been hurt by trusting. Now, you know, newcomers, they're going to come and they're going to go. That's the nature of Alcoholics Anonymous. But they've never hurt me. They've only helped me. So I have continued to use that. It says, I am Peg Martin and I'm an alcoholic. And what do I mean by being an alcoholic? And why say that in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous? Because I have a primary purpose. My purpose, my disease, is the greatest gift I've ever been given. There's another one. But this is one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given, is this disease. Otherwise, it's my dad, who was just my hero and who died a little over a year ago, said, if you're not an alcoholic, then what the hell is wrong with you? It's something he'd been saying all of my life. What the hell is wrong? We're lucky to be alcoholics. Listen to this. I love this. I love this. I wish I could quote it. But in the doctor's opinion, there's a part that it says in there that it basically says it's not sufficient to say that we have aberrant personalities and that we are downright mental defectives in full flight from reality. That's not enough. We're also physically addicted to alcohol. And boy, that was me. So I was a mental defective. I had a bad personality. And I was in full flight from reality. In addition, I was a juicer, as Casey said yesterday. I was a juicer. And lucky. I'm lucky. That's lucky. Because if we quit juicing, if we quit drinking in here, we can take care of the bad personality. A sponsor will do that for you. Don't say that. It hurts people's feelings. You know how we're very... But he deserves it. You know, whatever. Secondly, I am not in full flight from reality anymore. Sometimes I'd like to be. You know, I'd like not to be in reality. But reality's not so bad. Actually, it's better than a lot of spooky stuff that was going on in my head when I was drinking and that I was surrounded with. So it's not so bad. And I am in reality. And I am not an outright mental defective. Now, am I ever going to think like other people? No. I can have reactions like other people, but what I think, I can choose to hang on to or let it right go through. I mean, you know, I don't hold on to stuff anymore that is damaging. You know, when you're like these thoughts go through your mind, but it's our decision whether to hold on to them or not, those thoughts. and being a binge thinker, sometimes you'd be thinking like, she has on a pretty dress, what nice hair, I hate her. And you grab onto that thought, I hate her, I hate her, I hate her, I hate her, I hate her. You know, because she has nice legs or whatever. You know, I hate her, I hate her. I can choose to hang on to that, or I can choose to hang on to, she's got nice hair. And they didn't have nice hair, you know, or whatever it is. So I have a choice over those things today. I can choose to hang on to the negative, or I can take the positive. And I'll tell you what, I've always been a little bit of a Pollyanna, and I love to live in happy thoughts. And I think Alcoholics Anonymous is a place we go where we can have happy thoughts. And we can express our happy thoughts, and if they're not so happy, then somebody's going to say something to us. They're going to help us. It is a safe and well-lighted place, this place. And we don't shoot our wounded. Because if we were to shoot our wounded, there'd be the gunfight at OK Corral. And there'd be nobody left standing because we're all wounded. And I get the opportunity in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and in living the actions of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous of having happy thoughts and of having comforting thoughts and actually being able to think of you. I am the original Miss Piggy. I think about me whenever, ever I can. It may not be much, but I'm all I think about sometimes. And that, my husband says that, and it is very, very true. So Alcoholics Anonymous opens my mind enough with doing all the things that we do to be able to think about you. And I think sponsorship has a lot to do with that. And I think sponsoring other people has a lot to do with that. I want to be in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. This thing literally saved my life. I am 68 years old. Okay? 68. I can hardly believe it myself. I was sure I was going to be dead by 40. The poet Yeats, who happened to be Irish, well, he was very Irish, he wrote this little thing and it was wonderful. It said, being Irish, he was possessed of an abiding sense of tragedy, interrupted periodically by small periods of joy. Think about it. An abiding sense of tragedy interrupted by small periods of joy. Today, and that was my life. If I could think it was going to be tragic, it was going to be tragic. But today, my life is a long period of joy interrupted periodically by moments of tragedy. And that's my life. So, you know, when I say I'm an alcoholic, and through alcoholics, through the grace of God, an unmerited reward, the fellowship, and I think sometimes we don't give the fellowship enough credit. My group is my home group is the Foxhole Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Bellevue, Nebraska, meets on Tuesday night at 36 and W. And if you come by Omaha, which, why would you? But, oh well. It's a hotbed of AA. Otherwise, we got a lot of cows, and we got a lot of money, and we got a lot of stuff. But, it's a nice town. It's just, I love Gabe because we're both Midwestern, you know. You don't want, Gabe doesn't say much, but boy, listen when he does. Because it is what it is with Gabe. And I love that. I absolutely love it. I love he's a Wyoming boy. And there's nothing wrong with Wyoming boys, I'll tell you. Anyway, come by Tuesday night. The beginner's meeting starts at 6:30. The main meeting starts at 8. We have about 500 people in that meeting that take commitments. It takes, I don't know how many big coffee pots that we drink. And we have cakes and we'll feed you cake and coffee, and you can have a speaker meeting with. In that meeting, there are service commitments, and you get to be one of many. And you get to sit in a group and be one of many. And I'll tell you, we move each other on Sunday mornings. I mean, I go to 4 meetings a week. I'm a meeting maker. I make meetings. And I'm a superstitious type. I'm not changing that. So I go to at least 4 meetings a week. I have gone to 4 meetings a week forever and ever. When I first got sober, I went to meeting every night for 2 years. I wasn't busy. I didn't have a massive Washington, D.C. social calendar. I mean, I went to meetings because that's what we did. My sponsor, my first sponsor, Jane, said we go to meetings, we go to meetings, we go to meetings, because the miracle will happen if you just don't leave meetings. Okay, we'll take a poll in the audience. When people drink, what is the first thing they say when they come back? Stop going to meetings. They stopped going to meetings. And usually it was because they had a mood-altering experience. Let's put it that way. I don't know about you, but there's mood-altering people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you like everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're not going to enough meetings. Because I'll tell you what, there's some mood alterers in our group. But you know what's good about that? This is like a small town. It's 500 people. It's like a small town. Well, now we have 7 or 8 meetings a week. But the big meeting is on Tuesday night. I go Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and when I'm in town, Friday. And I have picked up a meeting on Sunday morning that I absolutely love because it's at 8 o'clock in the morning. I swore that I was never going to darken the door of AA before 10 o'clock. Well, here I am speaking at 9, for heaven's sakes. About 8 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning, and it's a great meeting. I sit in the fallen women section, and which is sort of sitting back in a coat closet, peering out on the rest of the meeting. It's just where we sit. And there's some fallen women there, too. But that group, if we can survive in that group and learn to be of service and help one another and greet at the door and do all those things that my sponsor right in the beginning got me to do, and I've been doing ever since because I'm a superstitious sort, you can survive anywhere in the corporate world, at the university, in places that are tough to take. You can survive. Get that group and others like it have taught me how to be a member of society, of how to succeed, and how to be loving and kind in doing so. We move each other so you get to see people's underwear, you get to see what kind of housekeepers they are, and we love each other anyway. We go to each other's funerals and marriages and go to court with each other, when they get divorced, or we go, we do those things together. And it creates a bond with the members in that group and others, because we are always getting new people come in. It's a bond that we have. And that bond, sometimes, when it's the rope or the river time, when it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and you're thinking about drinking, that may be the only thing you can remember. Is I don't want to lose my friends. I'll hang on to my friends, and we'll call one of them or whatever. So I really believe that the fellowship, it's our people. When I was growing up, I was a beatnik. I mean, that's how old I am. I was a beatnik. I mean, everything sucked. It was just... And today, I have found my people. And these are my people. And we're very strange. And I'm strange. I mean, I'm a bubble off a plum. I don't want to be like other people. I think it's boring to be like other people. They just sit around being normal and rust. And I don't want to be that way. I mean, I still got the squinty-eyed Tasmanian devil in me. What can I do to stir it up today? You know, I mean, it is just and it binge thinking, you know, it's just that, whoa, that would be fun, you know, whatever. And yet, I'm a good Alcoholics Anonymous member, and I don't take that for granted. I can think anything I want to. It's just my actions that count. It's what I do to make a difference. And God knows all of us owe amends up the yin-yang. I mean, we owe amends to public space. You know, don't you think? I mean, really, if you think about it, we do. And so much of change has to do with making amends. And Sharon talked about it, and Casey talked about it, and I was talking to Rusty about it this morning. You know, if we're in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, sitting in the grace of God, which is the light here, we will be given the opportunity to make amends to people that maybe we can't make amends to our parents who have died. Maybe we can't make amends to a casino in Elko, Nevada, or whatever. But we can make amends here. God will present us with people, substitute daddies, substitute moms, substitute institutions. It seems to me that I have been making amends to the cable company for years and years and years. That's the way it seems to me, because so many opportunities present themselves to that. And so, you know, it's just our job to find God's hand in those coincidences. That's what, if I stay in fit spiritual condition, then I can make those amends. Then I can see them. I can actually, when they are presented to me, I can take that opportunity and grab it. And so the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and meetings and sponsorship, that's the program. That's my program. That is the program, and it is something I have adopted for my own personal use. And I highly suggest that you do that for yours, because this is, you know what, this fits us to a T. We get to come to meetings, tell people the craziest stuff that's either going on in our lives or we're thinking about or did think about. Or we get to talk to people and tell them that in our closed meetings or whatever, and people are nodding instead of, get out of the room, you know, don't leave this place unclean, you know, and all of us are going, you know, that's funny. Wait till I tell you this, you know. We get to do that, and we get to find ways through sponsorship of making that right. We get to find things through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that make that right. You know, when I was about 15 years sober, I thought I was about as well as I was going to get. I thought I had completed the steps, you know, probably several times. I have had to do three kind of major fifth steps. And, you know, I thought, you know, well, okay, let's just put one foot in front of the other and keep going, la-di-da-di-da. And everything was sounding the same. You know, people in meetings were droning, you know, and things were not, my mind wasn't sparking. You know, it was just kind of, but the great thing is this. It's what Gabe has. Just do it. Just do it. Do it. Do the deal. Go to the meetings. Talk to your sponsor. Try to help others. Get through the day. It's what I think of as walking through a spiritual desert. We get to those places, and we're going to get to those places because we're human beings. We can't stay on overdrive forever. We're going to have times in drive in which we are supposed to act like normal human beings, whatever that is. And we're supposed to just do it. And that's little enough to pay, is it not? But we have to get through those periods. And so I have had to walk through some spiritual deserts in which I thought that it was a never-ending thing. And yet, looking back now from 42 years, back to 15 years, I realize at this point that I had just begun to grow. Just begun. I can hear newer people's minds ratcheting, and that's like, well, maybe you, but I got it together here. You know, what are you saying? I'm some kind of imbecile? You know, and I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is, for me, what happened was, and this is, I mean, I'm just sharing this with you. My ego rose from the ashes like a phoenix. And you know what? That ego has always been our problem, hasn't it? If you can think of ego as all kinds of ways. I'm better than you. I'm worse than you. I don't care about you. Or easing God out. You can think about it in lots of ways. But whatever it is, ego means I'm in charge. Get out of my way. Thank you, sponsor. I appreciate your direction. However, I'll take it from here. You're just an old lady. I know that your life is fine, but you know, I have massive, massive thoughts. I mean, I am like very, very smart. I am like outthinking you, lady. You know, so thank you. I'll call you. But I'll think my own thoughts. This is ego rising from the ashes. My case is different. I'm not the same as you. I'm different. Except that when you get to running your own life, mood-changing people appear everywhere. All around you. When my husband attempted to quit smoking one time, he said, about the third day, he said, I want you to know something. I am surrounded by idiots. Well, when my ego rises from the ashes, I'm surrounded by idiots. And that's, you know what happens when that happens? I rise above human aid. And I can't be helped. And when that happens, God help me. And usually he does. And it usually occurs in the form of a newcomer or somebody who comes to me with some silly problem that I have absolutely no emotional connection to. They have, who knows, it doesn't really make any difference. Oh, I have a good example. Just recently, I have a good friend of mine. I have sponsored her for many years. But she had a very bad experience with a pulmonary infection, oh, I don't know, 10 years ago. And she got this cough and cold again. She called me from the emergency room parking lot. I'm sitting here in the parking lot. I think I'm dying. I think I need to go into the emergency room and turn myself in. And I said, have you been to the doctor? You know, I mean, it's like, let's start with the doctor first, you know. Have you been to the doctor? Have you been to the doctor? And she said, yes. And he says, I have bronchitis and blah, blah, blah. I said, why don't you take him at his word? You know, I'm thinking in my head, listen, I'm going through a tough time here. Okay? I got stuff to worry about. Real stuff, you know, like maybe cancer or something, you know? I mean, what I'm thinking about, I mean, come on. You got a cold. You know, this is what I'm thinking. But what I say is, take a deep breath. But she couldn't. She was like, settle down. Put your hands on the car seat. She's having a full-fledged anxiety attack. She's Irish, you know, too. She puts her hands down like this. I said, now, sit there for 5 minutes and drive home. You know, and it just every time I get to thinking about, you know, my case is different. This is going to kill me. I'm going to, you know, if I do have cancer, I'm not going to have any hair. And my granddaughter is going to think, yeah, grandma, you got no hair. You know, it's got, oh. And of course, turned out to be nothing, which is always the way my, or seems to be my problem. And I'm not. You know, because a lot of people do have cancer, and they do have, but you know what? We always get through it, don't we? I mean, even if eventually we go on to the big meeting in the sky, we get through it. And if we're in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, we are surrounded by people who will love us and hold our hands and take care of us and always be there and, you know, with cards and flowers and help. And I remember years ago there was a kid in our group who was an adorable little kid, and he got astrocytoma, which is a very aggressive cancer, and he had it at the top of his spine, big star-shaped tumor. And Dick Hauser, who coached at Kansas City, had it, and he died like 6 months after he was diagnosed. So Jason was, oh, he was in terrible shape. And so we kind of rallied round, and he got the treatments, and we hired his mother to clean so she could be with him and that sort of thing. And what we do in a good group. And about 4 years after that, he was cancer free, and about 4 years after that, he developed a twist in his spine, and they had to do an operation because of the scar tissue from this tumor, take one of his ribs and thread it through his spinal column to hold him upright so that he didn't curl over for and cut into his kidneys, liver, and that sort of thing. And he was in a body cast for a year. Now, this is a 6 or 7 year old kid. And I can remember going over there. We took turns going over and reading to him and playing games with him. And because he had to lay, you know, he was in a body cast. He couldn't get up from the bed. And we helped him go to the bathroom and things like that. We had a regular schedule that was supplied by the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, I'm proud to say, that kid is in his last year in engineering school at the University of Wisconsin. And that can't happen. And yet here we were. We supported him. We cared for him. We cared for his mom all through that, like we weren't outright mental defectives. Like nobody could tell. You know, this is the right thing to do. I've learned integrity here. Do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. Don't just promise people things like you'll help them and don't show up. Because that's what we did when we were... That's what I did when I was drinking. I mean, I have developed, probably sometimes in spite of myself, some integrity. And life is life. Life goes on. You know, things happen. But I'm telling you that this program for us is the kit of spiritual tools that fits nuts like us. It is perfect for us. Bill Wilson were us. And Dr. Bob, they were us. And this was a there is no doubt in my mind, was a God-inspired program for godless people. And what the steps did for me when I was sober 6 minutes, the steps will do for me today. They don't know how long I've been sober. They don't know that I'm 42 years sober and occasionally crazy. They don't know that I'm any different than when I was 6 minutes sober. They just work. But when I get into those spiritual deserts, I think, my case is different. I need special help. Like a shrink or something, you know, or a heavy-duty super priest or something. And a counselor or a depression manager or something. But no. I just need the steps. I need to go back with a renewed commitment and start back at the front. I am powerless over alcohol and my life, and it makes my life unmanageable. I am powerless over, okay, let's say you have a resentment. I am powerless over Lenny, and he makes my life unmanageable. I'm powerless over Sally. She makes my life unmanageable. But came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity and made a decision to turn Sally over to the care of God as we understood him. You know, whatever it is, the steps work for me. Now, maybe not for you, but for me. Well, no, I'm serious. You know, there are people who need particular extra help, but it's only about 10% of us. That's 90% of us where the steps work. So if I think I'm different, it's almost automatically that I'm not. I'm just not. Now, I want to talk for about, I haven't told you that I drank, but I did drink. I drank a lot. I mean, I drank vodka, beer. I like beer too, Gabe. I think beer makes I could function, you know, I could walk. I was kind of dumb drunk kind of with beer, you know, and I had to pee a lot. And that was kind of a problem because I peed in inappropriate places, which is unmanageable in itself. And for those of you who think I'm going through my drunk log, please don't get restless. I'm not. I just want to tell you that I drank. I did drink. I drank beer. I drank vodka. I drank vodka in the end, and because it got me where I was going quicker and than beer did, and I didn't pee inappropriately either. So, you know, but it did hurt my liver, and I got cirrhosis of the liver, and I was given the greatest gift ever, really, before my sobriety. I was given the greatest gift, and that was the gift of desperation. I am a very proud individual, and you know what? When I was given that gift of desperation, it's something I wish for you. Because desperation, it doesn't sound like a gift, but it enabled me to take the steps to do what I was told. You know, I never was good at doing what I was told. I always told. You know, I always expected people. My father was a lieutenant general, and when he said, you did, you know, and I was not a lieutenant general, but I had the same finger that he did. And I went, I'm just like my dad, really. And when you point, you know, you do this. This is, I think, one of the reasons I make a good sponsor is because I got a good finger, you know. Poke him in the chest, you know. Old Buck Doyle used to do that. And when Dick, after about 6 months, Dick had a real sore chest bone right here because Doyle was always stabbing him in the chest with his finger. I loved it. Although we met after he got sober. But at any rate, you know, I was a drunk. I'm drinking a quart of vodka a day. I had cirrhosis of the liver. I looked like I'd been rode hard and put up wet. My sister had tried to frost my hair and drinking, and it turned bright bozo orange. So, I mean, I was like, because it'll do that to you if you have enough alcohol in your system. My blood was pink. It wasn't red. because it was so diluted with vodka that, well, anyway, you know what I'm talking about. And I had, I was real bloated and frog face, and all the orange places fell out. So I had like bald spots all over my head, and I came into Alcoholics and I was going like this, scratching those bald places where the hair fell out. And this woman walked up to me and said, "My name is Jane. I'll be your sponsor. You look new." And I was insulted. You know, as only a drunk can be insulted, because I had gotten dressed up for that meeting, let me tell you. And I remember the first thing we had. I was your regular belligerent, hideous newcomer. And she said to me, "What's the matter with you? You're mad at me." And I said, "No, I'm not," with great honesty. And she said, "Yes, you are." And I said, "Well, you hurt my feelings." And I said, she said, "Hurt your feelings? What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, I'm a sensitive individual." And she said, "You're not a sensitive individual. You're a touchy bitch." That's what she said. I didn't say that. Sorry, Rusty, but that's the quote. She did. She said, "You're a touchy bitch." And I was. I can be today at times, too. And then she said, "I want you to go back in the kitchen and work with Crazy Frank." I said, "I don't want to work with Crazy Frank. He's crazy." And she said, "I don't care." I mean, she saved my life, this woman, because I was desperate, and I did what she told me. So I went back, and she said, "Think of something to say to him. He's misunderstood. You know, he's 6'7", this guy, and he looked like Lurch. You know, I had Lurch." I went back in there, and so I went home and I thought about it, you know, and I came back and I said, "So, Frank, it must be nice for you being so tall." He said, "Why?" I said, "Well, you're a painter, aren't you?" "Yeah." I said, "Well, you can probably paint the ceilings without a ladder." And he goes, like that, you know. And suddenly I realized Frank was misunderstood. And he and I became a huge, great, successful cup washing crew. I mean, we were on. And then just when you get good at something, it's like the story of AA here. You get good at it, they make you change. So I had to be a greeter. And I'm a greeter today. I love being on the greeting committee. I mean, I love it. I love greeting people. At one time, we had a convicted felon who was on work release, Manny. Actually, he was from California. He had been stopped. His journey had been interrupted. And he was carrying his merchandise in a van crossing Nebraska. And he was interrupted in his journey. He was from Chino. And he spent many years in the federal penitentiary there in Nebraska for this interruption of his merchandise. And he was greeting with me. And then we had a teenager who had attempted suicide at 15, and we made the best triplets of greeting. I mean, we plotted our greeting. I mean, we were organized in our greeting. Janet had the newcomers, Manny had all of the guys, and I had the old people. You know, I mean, we greeted. I love greet, but she made me be greeter. I've done this. You know what? I do the same things I did in the beginning. In a nutshell, I'm still doing them. I'm just a little, just a tad slower today, and that's all. Because my enthusiasm is as great. Greater, probably, because I have more to lose. And I had nothing to lose then. But boy, I have a lot to lose today. So she made me be greeter, and I would greet people like this. "Welcome to the friendship group." That's my group. That was God's joke. "Welcome to the friendship group." And old, we had a guy in our group called No Growth McGee. And, you know, it's funny. I think we should go back to nicknames. I love the nickname. Blue-Eyed Lou, Lovable Bucky, Ernie the Attorney. You know, I mean, we had great names. Didn't we have great names? One-Legged Jack, you know. And then there was, what was that guy's name? One-Armed Lee, his name. Well, he got his arm caught under a train or something. I don't know. It was a terrible thing. He was just minding his business, drunk on the railroad tracks, and train ran over his arm, you know. Anyway, No Growth McGee said to me, "What color are your eyes?" I said, "Green." He said, "How do we know? You never look up from your shoes." Whoa, yeah. So I practiced at home. Welcome to the friendship group. And you know what? Today I make it a point to look people in the eye. I look them right in the eye because that's where you see the miracle. Miracles happen there. And so you know what I do? I've been doing this all these years. I have a great life. I just want to talk to you for the next 10 minutes. I'm trying to hit an hour, so. And I hope you're not bored. But too bad. As they say, this is my cat, and I'll skin it how I want to, I suppose. Really, I just want to talk to you about the last couple of years. When I was growing up, my father and mother were great people, are great people. My mother's still alive. She's 94. And my dad died last year at 95. So if I'm lucky, I'll be with you a while. And I absolutely adored and hated my father. Can anybody relate to that? I adored him. My God, the man. He was a doctor. He went to Washington University, graduated with, I don't know if the man ever made a B. From medical school, he became somewhat bored during one period of life, so he went back to school and got an engineering degree from another school, and then he got a pathology degree from Baylor University. I mean, you know, he's just one of those guys that you want to say, enough already, okay? I don't know if I can keep up with you. He was a military guy, and he was very well thought of. After he died, I had a stack of cards like this from the president, from Congress, from people who were, you know, very, very influential in the government and other places, the military, and from little people, little guys that he had helped along the way, and they were touching cards. You know, one of them, this guy said he had written because he kept thinking about my dad. He knew he was sick, but he didn't know that he had died. And I got this card posthumously. And he said, "I just wanted to thank you, Dr. Pledger, for saving my life." And I had to write him back and tell him that Dad had already died, but that I appreciated his card. And he wrote back, and I, at the bottom of it, he was from Wisconsin, at the bottom of it, he said, I wrote at the bottom of mine, "Go Packers," because it wasn't all sappy, you know. I mean, it was, I thanked him, and I promised him that, you know, I'm sure the dad knew that he was grateful. And so he wrote back and he said, "Would you like Packer tickets?" And I said, "Does a bear poop in the woods?" Of course I'd like Packer tickets. So I'm a huge football fan. And Nebraska, of course, and than the Packers. So I ended up getting seated in a box in the hoity-toity section of Lambeau Field, watching the Packers lose again, of course. Does, you know, and I asked him, I wanted to pay for him, and he said, oh my God, I owe more than that to your dad. So he was a man, and yet I hated him because he wanted me to be more than I was. He wanted me not, he knew I was a drunk. My mother just knew I was nuts. He knew, you know, he was the one that said, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, I mean, because I had been given these opportunities. I went to school in Europe. I was, you know, I was educated way beyond my intelligence. You know, I had, you know, I spoke several languages back then. I did all kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, I got a brain. But I'm a drunk. You know, I'm a drunk. And when I have all that stuff, I can't do it. I can't do the thing. I could speak languages better drinking, actually, than I could sober, because it releases all your inhibitions. But then I got too drunk to talk. I just drooled, you know. I mean, it was not a pretty sight. And he wanted more from me than that. And I owed him a lot. And I made amends to him. I remember I put him through an entire college graduation from Washington University, knowing I was not going to graduate because I'd been drunk the week of the finals. And that's a big deal. I mean, it was a lot of money, and it's a, you know, big deal. And so I really owed him a lot. So I went back to school after I got sober, and I got my degree, because that's what he wanted me to do. When I asked him what he wanted me to do, he said, get your degree. I went back to school, got my degree. I told Dick later, I said, I wonder if I should, like, ask him to pay for it. And I like ran it by my sponsor because I knew. And she said, I don't think so. You know, he paid for all that. So I paid for that. And later I was joking with Dad and I said, yeah, I thought about asking him to pay for it. And he says, good thing he didn't, because it wouldn't have. So that would have been good too. But I continued to make amends to him. Now, you really can teach an old dog new tricks. I wasn't really sure what heaven was like. I didn't even know if there really was one. You know, I just knew that if you lived well, this is the way I thought, if you lived well, that you'd be comfortable in this life. And that's true, don't you think? I mean, if we live well, by and large, we're going to be comfortable in our own minds in this life. But I didn't know about that. I mean, you know, it might be like a really good meeting or something when you go to heaven, like continuous good meetings. But I really wasn't sure. I hadn't really given it that much thought. Busy living today. Well, in November of last year, he made the decision on his 95th birthday. I could see it as clearly as anything. 95 is long enough. There's nothing really wrong with him, except he couldn't walk without pain. And I had been cooking for them and taking care of them. My mother has Alzheimer's, and my dad didn't want to put her anywhere until we had to. And that's a whole, if anybody wants to talk to me about that, I'll be happy to share with you, but it's too long to talk about. But it's quite a thing. It will really strain everything that you have. And I'll tell you, you guys, I owe you so much, so much. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, because you have taught, newcomers have taught me how to handle my mom. Anyway, so my dad started not eating. He gradually stopped eating. And along about January, I noticed something in his eyes. He had moved. He had moved. He was halfway home. And you know what? It was okay. He was happy there, and he was going to be happy. It was a tough time. February, I had to call hospice. I sobbed. I got down next to him. He was sitting in his chair. He had a big leather chair. Sitting in his chair. He was always cold. And I was piling blankets on him, you know, and stuff. And we live right across the street, so I was always over there. And I want to thank Dick for all his patience because, boy, it was a tough couple of years. And I piled these blankets on him, you know, and he says, enough already. You know, he's sweating. And I said, Dad, I'm going to have to call hospice. And he said, I know. And my mother was standing there. She goes, Kenneth, if you don't eat, you're going to die. And he said, yes. He said, yes. And it was just like, it's okay. And you could see him leave, moving. So this is like a ship sailing away, you know, sailing away. He's huge when it leaves, but it gets smaller and smaller until it disappears over the horizon. And then on the other side of the world, there's somebody seeing it coming, saying, here it comes. And that's death. And he moved. And it was one of the most wonderful experiences that I've ever had. And anybody who has seen a parent die or a friend will know what I'm talking about. It was peaceful. And he slid away. No pain. No gasping for breath. Just peace. And it taught this old dog that there is some place to go. We're going someplace. This is not the end. So I better shape up and keep coming back, because this is where it happens for me. In the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, the little miracles that we have happen. And I want to end with this, which is just a summation of my whole life. See, I owed that man that. My dad and I are okay. My mom and I are okay. She fell about a month ago, and she broke her hip and fell, whichever. And she went from an assisted living Alzheimer's place to a nursing home. And Lord, there's a world of difference. But I took her out in a wheelchair the other day, and I painted her fingernails, and we got her hair curled. I was pushing her out in the parking lot where the sun was, and we were taking a little ride, and she looked at me, and she goes, I feel beautiful. I'm so glad, you know, because I'm the one that she didn't know where I was half the time. I'm the one that gave her misery. All our parents really want, if they're good parents, is for us to be happy. And now I'm making her happy. And boy, you know what? That's a gift. This is a gift, guys. This whole thing is a gift. And there was a man walking on the beach. And there had been a storm the night before. And this guy was walking, saw that the sand was littered with starfish. And I'm an artist. I'm a watercolorist. And I love the colors at the beach. You know, they're all so pale and diaphanous. I love painting them. And the teals and peaches and beiges. And it was that kind of a day. And the man who was walking saw a guy picking something up and throwing it back in the ocean. And when he got closer, he noticed this guy was throwing the starfish back in the ocean. And the man who was walking said to the man who was throwing, what are you doing? And the guy said, I'm throwing these starfish back in the ocean. They can't live up here on the shore. And the man who was walking said, what possible difference can it make? There are thousands of them. And the man who was throwing said, it makes all the difference in the world to this one. So I want to thank you for making all the difference in the world to this one. Thank you.